there. This is the A Lot To Say podcast, a conversation-based project focused on unconventional career paths and the projects that consume us. I'm your host, Gary Williams, or Gaz, as many call me. And A Lot To Say is part of the Alt Projects family of content, obsessing about the overlap between creativity, technology, and culture. I'm fortunate to spend my days working alongside technologists, artists, researchers, and people who just generally give a damn about the world we live in. And I'm very lucky to be able to hear of some incredible career journeys over that time from some really inspiring people. So I am particularly energized by the projects that I hear people are experimenting and tinkering on along the way. And I thought, you know what, it's time to put these stories out there with the A Lot To Say podcast project. I can't wait for you to hopefully discover some new and lesser known stories about the things people get wrapped up in and what led them to this point. This is A Lot To Say. So for this episode, number 3 of A Lot To Say podcast, I'm joined by Nick Crocker, who's a partner at Blackbird Ventures. It was a fantastic chat, actually. I'm really chuffed to have had Nick involved. As part of his role at Blackbird, he runs the firm's Melbourne office. And Blackbird, to describe it a bit more, is a venture capital firm that exists to supercharge Australia and New Zealand's most ambitious startup founders. They were founded in 2012 and currently manage, at last count, around $500 million. And they partner with technology company founders to surround them with a community of other founders who have done the hard yards before. Regarding Nick personally, he has quite the varied background that has led into this point. So, you know, it's no accident that I was excited to have him involved on this as part of this chat to talk a bit more about his background. Day to day, he sits on the boards of companies like CultureAmp, Neura, Applied, Eucalyptus, Startmate, and Bellish. And he's worked on product strategy and operations at Under Armour Connected Fitness and was a product manager at MyFitnessPal, which was the world's most popular health and fitness application, eventually acquired by Under Armour in 2015. Prior to his involvement in other high-growth startups such as Sessions, We Are Hunted and Boxy, he progressed through life studying political science and law and then became a journalist and then caught the itch for the startup lifestyle, which, you know, we definitely touch upon. And I was really interested in the personal factors of why that was so. How do I know Nick? I don't really, to be honest. This podcast is obviously a great excuse to reach out to people and find out a little bit more about their background and what makes them tick. And it's a really fortunate byproduct of having these conversations and interviews to find out, you know, the things that influence people across their lives. We've crossed paths a few times for sure, and I've heard him speak at events where he's excellent. It was at one of these events actually where his, you know, his raw honesty and open account of his life sort of spilled out and actually inspired me a little bit more on the thought of the construction of this podcast project personally. So it was no accident that I, you know, reached out to him to ask him to be a guest. And as a fun fact, he was actually the very first guest to confirm appearing on the podcast. So good vibes all around. We dive into some of the aspects of his life almost immediately in our chat. But a large part of the reason for me approaching him was also based on his writing, which is frankly excellent. As I was heavily researching the background of Blackbird and Startmate Accelerator program in the past, he wrote some articles about the journey of establishing Startmate, his views on product marketing, investment, relationships with creators and more. And it was probably his emphasis on culture, pop culture, sports and the overlap with technology and leadership that really spoke to me. So sign up to his Substack newsletter Branches to get a taste of it, but we discuss that in more greater detail in the chat. And what else did we explore? Well, everything I just spoke about, but everything from culture to parenthood to technology to just an overriding passion. So hope you enjoy the chat with Nick Crocker. See you on the other side. All right, Nick Crocker, welcome to the A Lot To Say podcast. Great to have you on today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, look, my pleasure. I think, you know, it's a slightly surreal moment because obviously when you start to put, I know it's a very novel thing for a person to put together a podcast during isolation times, but you know, I've been following along with a lot of what you've been doing for quite some time. And so, you know, your name was one of the first that put on the list and, you know, now we're sort of here and I'm really pleased to have you on today.
Yeah, me too. Glad to be here.
Look, the focus is unconventional career paths and I guess the projects that consume us. You work, you're deeply integrated within the startup or technology ecosystem. Did you want to give us a bit of an overview of, I guess, your main role as general partner at Blackbird and what Blackbird's focused on? And then I guess we'll take it where it goes. We'll do a bit of sequential order of your journey, but also dive into some other aspects such as your writing, which are pushing out a newsletter, and a large amount of mentorship, advocacy, and so on. So let's talk about what you do, what your day-to-day looks like, I should say, at Blackbird.
So I'm a general partner, and there are five partners at Blackbird. Alex Sapoifis is our operating partner. And there are four investing partners, myself, Samantha Wong, and the two founders of Blackbird, Rick Baker and Nikki Shavak. And Blackbird was founded in 2011. And our mission in life is to fund the most ambitious Australian and New Zealand founders who have ambitions, not just on a local scale, but on a global scale. And I was actually the third entrepreneur that Blackbird ever funded. And so I've been knowing Nikki and Rick from the very earliest, most nascent days of Blackbird's history. So I go a long way back with Blackbird, and I got to know them as an entrepreneur. And it is a great joy to go to work every day. What I do now is that I spend most of my life working one-on-one with the founders that I have the privilege of investing in. And the best thing about investing is the diversity of problems that you get to solve in a given day. So it could be working on something at Culture Amp with Didier, building a culture first company at scale. It could be something around helping user researchers feel like heroes with Dovetail. It could be the future of consumer healthcare with Eucalyptus. It could be digital infrastructure for crafting and makers with the Bellish team, on and on. It's just the experience of being an investor is so diverse on a day-to-day basis that it is just the most interesting job, and it is such a privilege to work alongside the entrepreneurs that we work with. I really am grateful for it every day.
All right, Nick, so look, thanks for painting the picture of Blackbird. I mean, as we sort of mentioned just before the chat, there is a large amount of the audience within here that are not necessarily involved within the startup and technology ecosystem and are definitely curious about how, I guess, even the funding model works. But more so than that, I'd love to dive into the aspects of mentorship. And I'm going to, rather than go through your whole journey and what that's meant, I would love to start with a question and then think, I guess, track backwards from there. So regarding mentorship, how has that evolved over time for you? Have you noticed in yourself a shift away from, I guess, guidance in terms of mentors for yourself? So away from guidance, but and towards accountability in what you seek for yourself and your own personal goals?
It's a good question. I haven't thought about that for a long time. Let me just think about that for a second. Can you ask me the question again?
Yeah, definitely. So regarding mentorship, you have a heavily mentor-driven, role in your life, both in terms of, you know, what you've been involved with Startmate, and then of course throughout Blackbird and many other board roles. But my fundamental question is around how mentorship for you personally, in terms of how you receive it, has evolved over time. Have you noticed from your earlier days where it was, I guess, an aspect of guidance, that's become more, an aspect of accountability in what you're seeking?
Yeah, I think the really honest answer is my dad died when I was young, and I'm the eldest of three. So when your dad dies and you're the eldest, you end up filling some of the vacuum that's left in that paternal place in the family. And so I would say, if anything, I yearn for mentorship because I lost the most traditional kind of it when I was really young. I was 19. And I think what I've realized, I'm 36 now, and what I've compiled almost in the 17 years since he died is a composite set of mentors where I think for a lot of people, you get that mentorship from one, two, or three people, and it could be a father, a grandfather, or a really strong mentor in your own life.
Yeah.
The mentoring component of my life comes from a really diverse set of people. It's peers, it's people who are senior to me in age and in their career progress. I learn things from the people that report to me inside Blackbird. I learn things from the founders that I work with. And so I think I have compiled some kind of mentorship from the people that I spend my life with. But if I'm really honest, I would say that I still yearn for that. And maybe that singular mentor figure doesn't exist. But if I answer the question honestly, I miss it, and I wish I had more of it.
Yeah, we've dived straight into the philosophical questions, I guess. I mean, you've got two young children. So how has that, made you reflect or ponder about, a position of influence within your, obviously your children's life, but how has that learning experience been for the last few years? And a newly acquired second addition to the family, of course.
Yeah, so I have a four-year-old and a nine-month-old. The way I think about parenting or fatherhood is that you get out of it proportionally what you put into it. And I put a lot of energy into being a dad. And so I get so much out of it. So on the weekend, my four-year-old rode a bike with no training wheels for the first time. And I can't think of a happier moment for me in the last few years than that first moment where I just let him go and he rolled down the hill, but he wasn't going to fall. And I could just run beside him as he rode, and just the purity of it, the joy as he came off the bike and we were jumping around with our hands in the air. But of course, anyone who is a parent knows that those moments are quite fleeting. And they're definitely rewarding and joyful. But I do think that you earn those moments by the late nights, by the long put downs, by the resistance to teeth brushing, by the refusal to eat dinner, all those moments where you really need patience at the end of a long day or at the end of a stressful week. I think you earn the good times of parenting by sticking with it in the difficult times. And on the topic of mentorship, one of my mentors once said to me that when you have children, the relationship you build with them is like a rope, and you lay that relationship down thread by thread, and you build it over time. And at some point, that thread will be a rope that will be pulled very hard. And there's any number of ways that life can challenge a relationship between a parent and their child. And only at that point will you realize the importance of having invested in building the strength of that rope over time. And I've never forgotten that mental model of parenting, and I think about it all the time. I think the other
was
thing...
Advice? Oh, no, sorry to cut you off. Was that advice given to you prior to children or I guess in anticipation of it in the coming years?
Right before I had kids, by someone who had four of his own.
Right, okay. As a quick aside, my experience with my daughter who's five and riding her bike was a little more comical, unfortunately. She's terrible on her bike, and she went around a corner, absolutely stacked it. And I had to feel the guilt, not only of her, half injuring herself, but also the fact that we just got her a pretty cheap bike to start. So the thing just buckled and she never even had a chance. So, but I mean, to feel her wrap her arms around me afterwards, maybe made me feel a little bit better about myself.
Parenting is more like that than it is like my story on the whole. Yeah. I think before we leave the topic, I think I've had I've had, almost 5 years now of being a dad, and I still feel like a rookie. But the most helpful mental model that I've developed is that my kind of minute-to-minute experience of my time with my kids is proportional to the amount of empathy and creativity I have in that moment. And if you think of all the points at which you end up in conflict with your four-year-old or at loggerheads with your four-year-old, they're generally pretty good little humans that are pretty straightforward. And generally what's happened in those situations is your empathies for them has run out and your creativity to come up with solutions to get them through whatever problem it is. And they're usually pretty small problems like not eating dinner. That's when you run into the troubles of parenting. And so I always try in those difficult parenting moments to ask myself, have I had enough empathy for the fact that this is a four-year-old who just wants simple things in life? And have I really tested my own creativity to think of a way that we can get ourselves out of this bind?
Yeah, and absolutely.
Those are the two ways that I try and get myself through, the inevitable challenges of parenting young children.
Yeah. Look, we'll draw the parallel from both how you play a role in guiding your family, obviously as a part of a partnership, but and then extend that over to the work you do in your if people were to term it your professional life. But I would love to know your notions of, work-life balance or separation, but then also drawing those parallels is the fact that you sit on quite a number of boards. You're very regularly offering advice 24/7, it would seem. So by the same token, guidance, advice for many people's different shifting needs, how's that manifest in your life and how have you struck that balance?
Yeah, so on the work-life balance, it really just comes down to acknowledging that you can't do everything. And so certain parts of your life just naturally need to be left behind as you address, for me anyway, addressing giving my best to work and my best to my family that's basically all the time that I have. And if I have time outside of that, it's honestly pretty rare. And there's a certain amount of letting go that you need to do to just say that this is for a little while, this is just going to be how my life is going to be. And there's going to be a lot of things that I'm not going to be able to make progress on while I get through the early phase of being a parent. So that's on the work-life side, and it's just a constant balance. And obviously parenting in many cases is a team sport, and so it's not just balancing what your kids need, it's balancing what your partner needs. And my wife Jules is a doctor, and so she has a demanding profession. It's demanding of her energy, demanding of her time, demanding of her mental capacities. So that's a constant balance for us to make sure that neither one of us is sacrificing too much professionally, all the while making sure that our kids don't suffer as a result of us prioritizing career over or dedicating so much time to career. On the mentoring with founders front, I don't think I mentor I guess it's on a case by case basis. I'd say with some founders I have a mentoring role, but I would not, mentoring doesn't sit comfortably or accurately for me in describing the relationships I have with the founders that I get to work with. I would say it's a support or service role. Like I am in service to them. I am there to support them, and not the reverse. And that can take on many forms, and it takes on different forms week to week, depending on the challenges that the company faces. And also, frankly, I can help a little bit sometimes with the tactical stuff that founders are facing, but it's been a while since I've been a founder solving real founder problems. And so it's important also to acknowledge your limitations and not try and help where you actually can't be helpful. And so the most valuable thing that I am, I think, to the founders that I work with is I can be a reasonably good mirror. I can hold up to them a mirror and say, this, am I hearing what you're saying right? Am I understanding it right? And I can ask them questions about the reflection that they see to help them get a better understanding, because ultimately they're way smarter at being at the problems that they're solving and way better CEOs than I am or could ever be. And it's not about me mentoring them. It's just about me helping them to be better in themselves. So there's some element of coaching, but it's very much coming from that service mentality and not this sort of, you know, I sit on my throne and dole out high quality advice, because it's not that at all.
Yeah, of course. I mean, drawing on that, obviously with, as you've called it, referring to it as the service aspect, with that obviously will come a massive amount of stimulus conversations and so on. I want to focus in on, I guess, the concept of noise. And so noise is in that constant stream, you know, making a beeline directly to you, your inbox, your attention, distracting you, etc. How do you deal with it on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, being that it shifts so regularly and priorities change on the regular?
I'm still learning to deal with it, is the honest answer. So it's inevitable that with, I think I'm sitting on 9 boards now and have, you know, sort of primary relationships with 11 founders in the Blackbird portfolio. So on any given day, at least one of those founders will reach out with something, and that's 7 days a week, and it's founders in London, founders in San Francisco, founders in Australia. So if I just look at last night, I had a call until 10 with London, and this morning I had a call at 6 with San Francisco. So it is definitely, all consuming in that sense. And so I don't want to claim to have solved this, but things that I do is I have an old phone, and at the end of the day, I put my my day-to-day phone on the charger, and I shut the door to the study, and then the old phone just has like a camera on it and a podcasting app and no Gmail, no Slack, no Twitter, nothing that can draw me away from the moment. So yep. I find that useful as a physical disconnection from my work phone, which has got WhatsApp and text and Slack and Gmail and any number of ways that people reach out. And I just make the call that I'm not going to check my phone overnight. I'm not going to check my phone after 6 p.m. And that when I'm with family, I'm not going to have a phone nearby. So there's times where I'm just going to be unreachable. And I try and stay unreachable on weekends if possible. I try and defend that time with family. But I also have the reality of my job, which is that I have to deal with founders' problems on founder timelines, not on mine. It's not my job to say, well, if you've got this problem now, I'd rather us talk about it Monday because that's what suits me. That's not the dynamic that I think is the right one in the investor founder relationship. You know, my part of my job is, and part of my responsibility is, to be there when the problems are happening. And every job just has components of them that are non-negotiable, and I think that's one of the non-negotiable components of this role, is just when the founder needs you, be there and be present. And I think that really goes to why relationships matter in this business. This isn't just finance and dollars and equity and cap tables. I have to feel some positive jolt of energy when that founder calls and says, hey, I got a problem. Can we quickly talk it through on New Year's Day or Sunday morning or whenever it might be? And if you have that quality of relationship built up and you really enjoy the founders that you work with, you enjoy that time together, it makes that so much easier. And there's a great Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld, discussion with Howard Stern that's been going around Twitter lately.
Yeah.
Where he says, duty is finite, but love is infinite. And if you love the relationship that you have with the founders you work with, then you end up having something approximating infinite energy for it. And I think each investor comes to their role in different ways and different parts of it matter. But for me, that relationship is at the core of it.
I love that. I was going to lean into, some aspects of health, which we'll address both in terms of what you advocate for and also some of your career path. But what I'd actually also love to lean into, which might in some meta sort of way refer to what you've just referenced then, which is you create this great publication called Branches at the moment, but I've come to know a lot of, what you value and advocate for by the writing that you've been putting out there. And it's not as apparent as what people might expect in terms of, a constant narrative around venture capital investment or emerging technology. You actually hone in on culture, sports, and other aspects of leadership, productivity, and so on very regularly. A very healthy emphasis on pop culture, may I add. So you produced this incredible article about A24 and a love of, that company in the past, A24 being the production company producing Moonlight, Spring Breakers, and other nihilistic works like Hereditary, etc. But
which I refuse to watch, by the way. I watched the trailer and that movie looks terrifying.
It is absolutely terrifying, and I still am yet to put it out of my head. And to be honest, I actually broke down the entire script for my wife, and she still can't watch it, but she can't forget any aspect of it, not having seen a frame. We'll get into that at a later point.
Yeah.
But the point I was making was you were talking before about, the separation, the seeking inspiration, separating your time from, say, a phone and then being in the moment and, seeking to get inspired. How have you sort of found a really important role in music, film, sports, etc., in re-energizing and motivating you daily and somehow influencing your engagement with founders and creators? Because it seems apparent from your written output.
Yeah. I mean, the foundational piece of all that is just a profound obsession with music. And I'm pretty sure I've had a lot of conversations with different people about music over the years. And I think there's something in my chemical makeup that makes me unusually responsive to music. Like I feel it in a way that I think most people don't feel music. And so that's just a joy, honestly. Like to just think about, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I've never done drugs. The closest thing I can approximate it to, having not done any of those things, is that total feeling of just having the music make you feel different in a chemical way. And so that's what music is for me. And as far back as I can remember, I still remember watching Rage on a black and white TV in 1990, and I can still remember the songs that I would see on Rage. Like they made such a profound impact on me. I can still remember the first time I heard Deep Forest, and then the next song that was played was Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name, but that was the back-to-back. I can still remember those moments, and I don't think that's the normal of experience of music for most people, but it's my experience of it. And so I just get to tap into that every single day. So opening Spotify for me is just like, it's just such pure joy. And the discovery of new music that I love is just like such an intense rush. And I just feel so lucky and to have that relationship with music and to be able to just access it at any time, anywhere. If I have my phone, I can access all the world's production of music and all of human history and just have it make me feel a certain way. And so naturally, given that I feel that way about music, I seek it out all the time, and I seek out new music and I seek out old music and I seek out classics and I seek out my favorites. And it's just such a huge source of joy in my life. And I think in a way, like it's it's a very personal thing. You know, for I think maybe in high school, people associate music with social status, like bands you love are part of your identity, and it's cool to love certain bands and love certain bands together. But music for me has just evolved into something just deeply personal, where, like, for example, most people would be ashamed to admit that they love Justin Bieber, but I thought the Justin Bieber record this year, if you can ignore the lyrics, which aren't particularly great, but just sonically and melodically, amazing. And the new, like last year for me, that record was the 1975 and going into the 1975's catalog. But I think people still maintain that, like, music has social status, and they want to signal that they like certain music to say that they are a certain person. And I think that's what I'm just feel really comfortable with, is that I've evolved past that. And it just, like, if I love the music, that's all that matters. And it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. It's just a personal experience for me.
It's funny, because I'm sure we've all experienced this in our lives, but also that feeling, which may still happen, but when you love something, you know, you love a new act so much, and you almost don't want anyone else to, you know, they're yours, like you found them or discovered them. You almost don't want more people to know, but maybe that's a selfish youth type thing. I'm not sure. I think I'm in much the same mindset. I mean, even evaluating, I guess, through, say, Discover Weekly and certain tracks or sort of genres I'm diving into throughout, say, isolation time, it's really interesting to sort of backtrack through that sort of stream of songs or artists that I've added to a list, and then sort of, I guess, see some association with how I may have been feeling at certain times and which styles I gravitated towards.
Oh, but music transports you to place in such a profound way. Like, there are certain songs that you can just, like, if I put on Arcade Fire's Funeral record right now, like, I'm transported back to the, like, it wasn't even a hotel, it was like a youth hostel in San Francisco. I went to Rasputin Records and I bought that CD, and I had a Discman, and I played it on a Discman, and those first chords ring out in frosty San Francisco in a youth hostel for me. I'm just, like, instantly transported by that record. And yeah, it's like time travel. And so I agree.
Look, we won't wax lyrical on and on about music, even though I would absolutely love to. But obviously, it's no surprise, obviously, that you've then gotten involved in, I guess, these, you know, these companies that create things, and whether that's related to music, such as with Neura, or other ones that create things that I guess you could associate in some ways with, you know, some form of, you know, magic. They're creating, they're inventing, and they're experimenting to be able to create them. I still vividly, vividly remember having a very emotional experience while listening to a Neura headset for the first time. But how is it when, I guess, from the investment side, when a pitch or a product like that comes across your desk, so to speak, how does that trigger an emotion within you?
Well, that's really at the core of my love for Neura is that first experience I had when Dragon, I was in San Francisco, and Dragon came and demoed the headphones, and you needed a suitcase to power them at that point. And I heard music that I thought I had heard before, and I heard it in a completely different way. Yeah. So that is obviously so deeply in my kind of passion groove. That's an easy one. I don't think all companies need to fall as squarely in the passion groove for me. I think I can get as passionate about Neura as I do about Applied's hiring software. The thread is that there is originality and there is creativity in the solutions that these founders have come up to or come to again up against problems that I care about.
And some of these companies or the problems that they're solving, I mean, well known to the general public, you would have groups such as that Blackbird have invested in, Canva, LifeX, Redbubble, etc. And then some others that are not as well known to the general public. So perhaps Zooks or Cortical Labs, who are creating hybrid biological computer chips. I mean, this is incredible, incredible stuff. What are those sort of first general interactions with these founders, and how does what's a general investment process for you that you are most comfortable with? I should ask.
Yeah, I think the best investment pitches feel like interactive lessons, where the founder is teaching you something about the world that you didn't. Or you thought you understood, but you didn't really, and they're giving you an entirely new perspective or a new way of understanding something, or they're just teaching you something completely novel, and you interject along the way, asking questions and clarifying. And I love that feeling when you come out of a pitch thinking one way about the world. You start the pitch thinking one way about the world, and you come out of it thinking a completely different way because the founder's taken you on a journey. I think a really good mental model of what founders do is they live in the future, they invent products for the future, and then they come back to the present to show us what the future looks like. And our job is to find versions of that future we believe in and we want to make real and to fund those. And so great investment pitches feel like the future brought forward. And the investment process is very, very varied in terms of how long it takes and the steps and the diligence and the deep dives and the customer references and the meeting the team and the experience of the product and the product demos. There's, you know, I could go on and on about how many ways that diverges. But the common thread through it all and through the investments that I do and through the investments that any of the Blackbird partners do is what we call internally love at first sight. And you do have to have a tremendous amount of conviction in something about the company to carry you through all the inevitable sort of reality checks that you'll get as you uncover all the reality of what the company is really about. But there has to be some driving force underneath that just says, okay, I can accept that this isn't right, or that this is wrong, or that this could be better, or that this has been terribly done, or that this person isn't in the company, or this person is in the company and they're in the wrong role. Like, you would find all these things that you don't like through the process of diligence. That's inevitable. But there has to be something that you love that drives it over the edge for you to maintain that conviction against the natural disbelief of anyone who's saying, coming up with reasons why something won't work.
Yeah. And I mean, you've actively voiced, because by the same token, you've said you're trying to understand whether you'll be entering into a decade long relationship with these people. You've talked about concepts of, you know, what you're looking for in founders or creators, you know, that grit, determination, just willingness to go there, I guess.
Yeah, and founders are all unique in their own way. There's not especially Australian founders, there's just no cookie cutter, you know, they went to this university, they studied this thing, they worked at this place, they launched this company and their company looks like this. Like, that just doesn't work. I think I would love one day to assemble all 130, let's call it, founders that we've ever invested in the entire history of Blackbird, and just get them all into a room one day, because it would be the most diverse, interesting group of people with the most extraordinary range of backgrounds, solving everything from putting rockets into space to how to hire people and make sure that they stick around for many years at your company, to just on and on and on. It's really the most diverse, extraordinary group of people. And that, I think that is what makes doing this job such a privilege.
Yeah. And so in terms of your journey, I mean, it's been a, as with everyone, it's a rolling series of occurrences, and obviously I'm assuming a certain amount of serendipitous exchanges throughout the way. But you were studying political science and law, and you were also doing a hefty amount of music journalism. But you, why don't you tell us about that experience, and then your eventual beginnings in Boxy?
Yeah, one of my colleagues, Alex, introduced a concept to me recently, and this was in reference to someone we've hired recently. He described them as having covered an awful amount of distance. And I sort of dug into what that meant. And he said, for them to have come from where they started to where they are today is a really long journey. And he wasn't talking in terms of length of time. He was talking about the likelihood that from where they started, they would end up where they are today. And I was speaking to, you know, the kind of the nature of their journey. And so I think sometimes I grew up in Queensland. We lived 35 minutes outside of Noosa on 12 acres. We had 9 acres of rainforest and 3 acres that was cleared. We had this big wooden house, the classic old Queenslander house, if you've ever been to Queensland.
Well, I get to see it on Bluey every day now.
We'll come back to Bluey. Bluey is amazing. For anyone listening who has not watched Bluey, even if you don't have kids, Bluey is a masterpiece.
It certainly is.
So you've distracted me now with Bluey.
I'm sorry.
I'm a kid growing up in the bush in Noosa. It's not even when people say Noosa, that Melbourne people are like, oh yeah, I've been on holidays to Noosa. I'm like, yeah, but you haven't been 35 minutes out of Noosa in the bush. You know, like I feel like I lived closer to Gympie than I did Noosa, but anyway, that's another story. So definitely growing up there, there weren't heaps of entrepreneurial role models. I didn't know what venture capital was. My dad made fine furniture. My mum was a GP or is a GP. And when you're a GP in a rural area, you see everything and help everyone. But certainly there was no entrepreneurial kind of role models in my life growing up. And I never even had a concept in my head that, like, I knew there were jobs, but I never really thought about the other side where there were founders creating companies that create jobs. So I think growing up, I would just say what I thought was the right answer when people said, what do you want to do? And I would try and like say things that sounded impressive without having any connection to them at all. So I used to say, oh, I want to be an international human rights lawyer. But then I got to university and I did political science and I did Spanish because I wanted to have the three languages. I lived in France after school to learn French. I did law and did all the electives around the kind of human rights side of law. But it was just not for me. And it's quite hard when you're 19 or 20 years old to deal with that cognitive dissonance of I'm studying law. I'm doing this thing that everyone has said for my whole youth growing up was like the good, right thing to do. And yet I feel so disconnected from the reality of it. It's quite a sense of dissonance with that. And it took me a couple of years to resolve it, why it felt like I was wearing shoes that were two sizes too small, basically, until the age of 25. Yep. So as you mentioned earlier, I was a music journalist, but I parlayed that journalistic work into a column for News Limited in Queensland in the Sunday edition of the News Limited paper, which is called the Sunday Mail. So it was the most read paper in Queensland. And I had a column for a year or two where it was called the Y Files, profiling on, you know, inspiring Generation Y people. And so I interviewed politicians and poets, puppeteers, jewelers, artists, all kinds of interesting people. And then finally I did a profile on entrepreneurs. I found some entrepreneurs that I thought I could do a profile of. And when I remember going to interview them for the article and just finally felt like I'd put on a pair of shoes that fit. And it was a very, very rapid transition from figuring out that there was such a thing as being an entrepreneur. So I would have been 25 at this point, which is when I really first realized like, oh, you can start a company when you're 25. You don't have to wait. You don't have to be given permission. You don't have to, you know, take 20 years to get there. You can just go and do these things and figure them out. And meeting people who'd done that was very, very inspiring to me. And so that was the really key turning point in my life, was figuring out that there was this thing called being an entrepreneur. And so I would say within 3 months of doing that article, I joined a startup as the first employee, and it happened to be a music startup. So it combined music, the journalism part of my job and then entrepreneurship. And this was in the early days of iTunes, and we helped independent artists get their music on iTunes because iTunes had given access to the major labels, and they'd given just a couple of other aggregators, they called them, access to help independent artists get their music online. And I would say from that point to today, you can look at it a few different ways, but it's felt like a reasonably large amount of kind of entrepreneurial experiences crammed into a decade. So started three different companies and had all three of them acquired, worked at three different companies as a product manager, one a startup called Boxy in New York, one MyFitnessPal, which acquired my startup. One was Under Armour, which acquired MyFitnessPal. So I had this really diverse range of running a one-person startup, as I did in Brisbane, and then running my own startup, and the experience of the US and raising money in Silicon Valley and working in venture-backed startups. And I just feel like I crammed a lot into 10 years, and a lot of that was fortune, and a lot of that was just a internal drive never to feel like I was wearing the wrong size shoes again, to really make the most of my opportunities. And I think all those experiences set me up really well for what's now this phase of my career, which I think is, whereas I crammed a lot of different things into 10 years, I think I'll be doing what I'm doing now for hopefully many more than 10 years. And
yeah, of course.
Sort of all of that period of founding companies and being an operator was all just refining my picture of what I really wanted to do every day, and acknowledging when I felt like I was in the zone and when I was in my element. And I feel really fortunate that that's what being an investor feels like to me now, is I feel in the zone. I feel like in my element every day. I never feel bored. I never feel like I'm pushing it. It just has its own sense of momentum, and that's how it's felt for the 4 years that I've been doing it. And that's a great thing to say about a job and something that you spend more time doing than you spend on any other part of your life.
Oh, for sure. I'm passion letters here, you know, I guess, so to speak. I would love to just very quickly, as we get towards the end, and thank you so much for letting us know about all this. I mean, I know you've spoken extensively on podcasts about your journey and dived into greater detail about each of the companies that you've been involved in, but, you know, obviously that's covered, you know, music, health, and much more with a number of product roles, strategy, operations within there. But I want to go back just to that moment as you were investigating, you were doing the journalism, you've met with founders. What was it that attracted you to that world? Was it around, I guess, the aspect that, oh, well, shit, I can just create something? Or was it, I guess, the manner in which the people you met communicated to you? Were you allured to, I guess, perceived free lifestyle? Like, I'm not sure, but I'd love to know your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I remember there's two key moments. So the first one is I moved from Canberra to Queensland when I was in grade 5. And on my first day of school in Queensland, a couple of kids called me a square. And I didn't know what a square was, but I figured it out eventually. And I realized, like, it wasn't a good thing to be. And so I sort of, from in various ways, from grade 5 to 25, I had just believed that if you have ambition and you really want to go for it, that's actually something that's best kept to yourself. And so I remember going in, interviewing these three guys who all had different businesses, and they all worked out of this space in Brisbane called the Substation, which was this amazing old electricity substation, three levels, and these three entrepreneurs with these three businesses working out of that space. And we went up onto the rooftop, looked overlooking Brisbane, and I'd known them for, at this point, I'd been interviewing them for 3 minutes. Like, I came in, hey, how are you? We went straight up to this rooftop. Yep. And before we'd reached the top of the roof, they'd already agreed that we were going to do a half marathon together 2 weeks later. And it was like, like the energy and that, there was just this raw, like, okay, cool, let's do it. Yep, done. Okay, next. Yep. There was just this sudden like pick up in my energy where I just thought, like, there's almost nothing I could say to these guys. Like, I could blurt out all the things and all my internal ambition and drive. And their response would almost be like, okay, well, what else? Is that it? You know, like it felt like it was accelerating this part of myself that I'd had to kind of keep hidden. And that was what was exciting to me about entrepreneurship, was that it was just this really clear expression of the fullness of who you were. And there was a fearlessness to it and a permissionlessness to it. It's not a word.
Yeah.
You didn't have to ask people for permission. You went and did the thing that you wanted to do. And that was so freeing to me. It was inspiring and energizing. And I finally realized, like, I can be myself when I'm around entrepreneurs.
Love that. Yeah. Look, I guess that freedom to explore has definitely been a recurring theme throughout the podcast. Look, we're going to end it now. I'd love to ask you one question. Love to know your thoughts on this specifically. Are we potentially within Australia, if we're talking about emerging companies specifically focused on technology, are we potentially too homogenous in what we're creating? So are we too obsessed with being, you know, sort of there's a lot of usage of whether Airbnb or the Netflix or the Uber of X. Are we too homogenous in how we are, or as opposed to, I guess, a culture or a focus on experimentation and wonder and invention?
I'll be very biased in my answer, and I'll answer on the behalf of the entrepreneurs that we're invested in at Blackbird. The range and scale of their ambitions and the problems that they're solving is so broad and so wild and so mind-bending, whether it's rockets, satellites, self-driving cars, lasers, creating food in a petri dish, replacing meat with alternative protein, and, you know, even whether it's safety culture revolutionizing the way that companies manage their, you know, occupational health and safety globally, or Culture Amp driving cultural change, or Canva unlocking people's creativity. Like, it's so inspiring. It's the one part of the Australian sort of economy that is just so undeniably exciting and inspirational and energized and optimistic. And it's such a positive place to be operating that I'm incredibly optimistic about it. And it makes me incredibly optimistic for the future. And at least from my vantage point at Blackbird, I feel like we're only just scratching the surface of what is going to be possible.
Wonderful. No, I love that. Yeah, look, for everyone who's listening today, do check out the portfolio. It's incredible. And by the same token, do dive in a little bit more to Nick's journey, in particular in establishing Startmate within Melbourne, which is an incredible story in and of itself. And wonderful. I mean, when we're conducting this interview, it's just, I guess, the day after a number of applications have been received for the newest Startmate intake. And I think you absolutely smashed targets, over 600 applications received.
Yeah. That's another thing to be optimistic about, that we run a Startmate accelerator program every 6 months, and 6 months ago, 400 people applied, and today 600 people applied with their company. So that's 1,000 people out there saying, right, I'm going to go on my own journey and start a company. And
yep.
That's such a great thing.
That's powerful. Look, Nick, I won't hold you up any longer, but I want to thank you so much for being on today, and just honestly appreciate so much of what you do, but I'm really, really thankful for you taking the time. Please do follow Nick Crocker on Twitter at Nick Crocker, and also his Substack. It's called Branches, isn't it?
It is, nickcrocker.substack.com.
Beautiful. Ask him about getting up every Saturday morning and going through a couple of hundred emails to compile the content. That's another story.
Such a joy.
Nick, thank you once again. I really appreciate it. See you soon.
See you soon.
So that was my chat with Nick Crocker as part of the A Lot To Say podcast. I had a lengthy intro to open this talk, so I'll keep the outro brief. You know, Nick was really enjoyable to interview and he's an excellent communicator. So I mentioned to him after the chat that the reason I connect with his story was because of, you know, some parallels and similarities. And hopefully people listening to this episode of this one and others get to experience the same feelings of association, if that helps them. So you can follow along with Nick on Twitter primarily, as we mentioned, at Nick Crocker, and also sign up to his branch's Substack via nickcrocker.substack.com. You can follow along with Blackbird at BlackbirdVC, Blackbird.VC, I should say, and at BlackbirdVC on Twitter and Instagram. So that was A Lot To Say with Nick Crocker, exploring unconventional career paths and the projects that consume us. I've been your host, Gary Williams. And music in this podcast is from my old band, Bateman, actually. It was programmed by our drummer. And while we don't actually sound anything like it, we're actually a harsh metal band, he's now a bona fide Australian country music star. So follow along with Gareth Leach Music. Follow A Lot To Say on the Alts Project social media channels at Alts Projects. Thanks again. See you on the next episode.